Let me give you a little bit of background about who I am, and for this panel, arguably more importantly, who I am not. I am not my patent lawyer colleague who was going to be here today, who would have had a great opportunity to talk to you guys about some of the tech on a level that would have been accurate and in-depth. I am not a patent lawyer. That means I do not have a scientific background, nor a technical one. I am an IP lawyer, intellectual property, but I focus predominantly on copyright and trademark. I know enough about patents to get by, but I am not a patent lawyer, and I'm not a tech person. So a fair amount of what I was reading in the opinion, even written by the judge, and heaven help me when I was reading some of the briefs from both sides, I don't know. I was reading a few of the more techie blogs trying to brush up when I found out my colleague would not be here going, okay, well, I'll learn that too. And I read it and said, yeah, I know what all those words mean, but in that order, I have no clue. The catch is, I am very typical of both lawyers and judges. I have a great liberal arts education. I have a degree in economics. I took a lot of math classes. I have programmed, if you count the true basic programming I did in college, which dates me a bit, I suspect. And I had the privilege of crashing the University of Virginia mainframe completely in an impossible fashion. I was banned from computer labs across the campus because when I was trying to write my program to pick a number from 1 to 10, this was Computer 101, I have no idea how I got out of Kermit. Yes, they named our server Kermit, which I assume was a hint that we were Muppets or Sesame Street levels of computing. And I crashed the entire mainframe, which ran the university systems. They did not make payroll that month because it was all computerized and I killed it. They do not know how, but the grad students who ran the computer lab told me never to come back, and they meant it. Literally, my photograph was there. This is my technical background. Yeah, it may still be there 20 years later. That's my technical background. So when it comes to doing computers, I can use them. I own an iPad. It's very cute. But see, I know. That again tells you, and I was just telling Scott, I bought the iPad. It's the first gadget I've actually wanted, which tells you who they market to. Apple likes people like me. It was really cute, and they had a little animated thing where the cover curled up and down, and I thought that was adorable, and so I bought it. That's probably not what appeals to y'all, but I am the kind of person who writes opinions. I get to be a judge. They don't usually pick people who have technical backgrounds to be judges. There is a small subset of lawyers. The good news is the judge in this case is one of those. He has a math degree. I'm assuming he was a patent lawyer when he was in practice because he has a math degree. That's really weird for lawyers. There's a standing joke amongst us, amongst all of us except those patent people, that someone will laugh when we can't add correctly or when we look at a table full of numbers and go, ooh, if that's on a balance sheet, I'm not sure how to deal with it. And the joke usually is along the lines of, well, sure, if I could do math and science, I'd be a doctor. And that's pretty much true. You can tell that to your lawyer friends, and they'll kind of do this. They'll laugh, but they won't want to, because, yeah, it's true. We are like that. We're really good with words, and we're not so good with anything else. Normally, we feel okay with it, because folks who are really good at science and really good at math usually struggle when it comes to language with people. And we kind of get all, ha-ha, I can talk to people. I can write thousands of pages and not break a sweat. And yeah, really, the science and the math background is much more practical. Again, the good news in this case is your judge is a programmer. He understood all of this, and he was able to come back with a well-reasoned and really good opinion. And I think this is the first time I've stood in front of this room and said, this was a good decision. This is a well-written opinion. Usually I have lots of things to snipe at and say, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong. He got it right. Before we get into the details of the case, I kind of want to back up and talk about the law, which is mainly because that's what I know, and that's what I can talk to you guys about, because I could try to explain some of the technical details to you, and that'd be foolish, because A, I don't get them as well as you do, and that's not what we're here to talk about mainly. The problem with the law in this area is that copyright is really not meant for software. Software is smack dab in the Copyright Act. There's no way around it anymore, but it was a stupid decision when it started. It's a stupid decision now, and cases like this are going to suggest why, as a general rule. I think that was my phone. Let me turn that puppy off.
It's embarrassing when y'all's phones go off. It's worse than mine does.
Well, that was mine.
That was yours?
I will turn mine off anyway, so I don't think I did.
buried deep enough on my mind.
Okay.
It wasn't mine. I don't feel as bad.
Intellectual property is broken into three basic categories. One is trademarks. We don't talk about that at all today. Trademarks are Dasani. It's the brand names. It's so you know what it is you're buying. This camera up here says Canon across the front of it. Trademark. Anything, Sharpie, trademark. All the brand names, all the logos, those are your trademarks. Those are not at issue today at all, so we're not going to ignore that completely. The other two areas are copyright and patent. Patent is the place, now, by the way, if you're ever filing a patent, get an honest-to-God patent lawyer. There's a separate segment. They have a separate test. They have to have science backgrounds. They are different than the rest of us. If you ever need a patent lawyer, ask specifically, have you passed the patent bar? Are you a member of the patent bar? Ask them that. If they are not, they are not a patent lawyer, do not hire them. Don't hire me to do your patent. You'd be an idiot. So, patent is intended to protect the scientific discoveries, the invention, not discoveries, the inventions, machines, processes, things along those lines. When you build the apocryphal Beta mousetrap, you patent it. Now, patent gives you very broad protection. With a patent, you can keep anyone else from doing what you have invented, even if they came up with it on their own. So if I was at home inventing some stuff, and someone else filed it first, and I invented it and said, hey, this is great, I have a mousetrap that will catch mice in the next county. Dude, I'm happy. And I say, I'm going to make my mousetrap and sell it to people who would like to have fewer rodents. Okay, so far so good. But little did I know, 2 weeks ago, someone went to Washington and filed a patent for a similar mousetrap to catch multi-county mice. Well, even though I didn't copy theirs at all, I didn't even know they existed, they can stop me from catching mice in different counties as long as their clever patent lawyer wrote the patent broadly enough to cover what I'm doing also. So it's not that I'm copying their science or their discovery, it's that I'm accomplishing the same thing. They can preclude people from doing the same thing they're doing. And it's a very broad protection. Copyright is much more narrow, but science it's intended to basically reward the inventor with a monopoly period. You get your patent for 20 years and you get to be the only person doing that. Medicines are a common one that we know about. For 20 years, the drug company gets to sell only their drug. There won't be any competing generics because no one else is allowed to make it. And that's the reward you get for inventing something good. You get to be the only guy doing it for 20 years. And then the benefit turns the other way. Then we get the reason the government was willing to enforce your monopoly for 20 years. Then it becomes public domain and anyone can make it. After your drug's been out for 20 years, then it becomes public domain, then the generics come up. And that helps so the drug companies got their reward, they had 20 years of good profits, and then the public gets their reward, the rest of the valuable use of the product, without any restrictions. That's how patents are supposed to work. Now, with the patent process, it is long and it is expensive. There is no quick way to get a patent, and there is no cheap way to get a patent. Don't get a patent from LegalZoom. You kind of get what you pay for there. But there's no quick way to do it, and there's no cheap way to do it. Most of them are going to cost, a simple one will cost you between $10,000 and $50,000, probably closer to $50,000, and it'll take a number of years, if you're lucky. The patent examiners in D.C. are so frighteningly overburdened that there's a huge backlog for even simple things to be reviewed, and it's, for years I've been saying that I can pick a racehorse better than I can a patent outcome. The Patent and Trademark Office, I think they've been putting something in the water because some of the things that are coming out of there are just ridiculous. And there's literally a patent for, swings on the playgrounds, right? Go sideways and do kind of attack swings. You've all done that. And then whoever the teacher was said, knock that off and swing like a normal child. Quit doing that. You're causing trouble. Go back to the other way. Someone patented swinging the wrong way on a swing. I kid you not, I have looked it up. It is in the U.S. patent database. It is a valid patent. So if this guy wanted to, he could go to the playground and stop you from swinging sideways on a swing based on his U.S. patent. To my knowledge, he has not enforced that patent, and I wish it were an urban myth. The first time one of my students said, there's this patent about swinging sideways. I'm like, oh, no, come on. No, it's there. I've pulled it up. It's an honest-to-God patent. So when you know that that gets patented, you know that patents are out there for the stupidest stuff imaginable. And when it comes to software, it's even worse. Software, the two patents at issue in this case again, a fair amount of it, I'm reading the patent going, I have no idea what they're talking about. Well, I have read the reviews from several programmers and techie folks, and one of my friends, indeed, I said, okay, you got to read this because I got to talk about this. And he's like, I read it, and I program in Java, and I have no idea what these patents are about. The patents are written rather obliquely, and even for someone who actually does work in that area, he read them and said, I really don't know what's protected from that, because what they're talking about seems really obvious, and certainly would not have been original at the date of this patent. So the only thing I understand from that is something that certainly shouldn't be patented, otherwise everything I do at work I should be filing patents on. Because, you know, the idea of having coffee before starting a long project is original by these standards. The other thing about patents, I need to back up one step, is that there's a high originality standpoint. If anyone else has done it before, it cannot be patented and protected. So it has to be original and novel. So the patent examiners, one of the things they do is search what we call the prior art, which is, say, everything anyone has done before. There's not really a searchable database of everything anyone has ever done. So a lot of patents go out with very blatant prior art that someone who worked in the field would have known about. More than once, just some dude who got pissed has gotten patents reversed by going and digging up the prior art himself and saying, you've got to be kidding. No, look, this was commonly in use in the industry 10 years earlier. You can't patent it now. Well, yes, you can patent it now because the patent examiners don't have enough time to do a comprehensive search. And so a lot of things get patented, and in software, it really becomes fodder for the huge patent wars that you see going on now. The patent trolls. Y'all probably heard that term. The patent trolls are firms who don't invent anything. They just buy up masses of patents and then sue people on them. Their entire income generation is from litigation and intimidation. Because half the time, they don't even have to go to trial. I mean, they've got their own lawyers, in-house lawyers, and so they can go to trial all day long. It doesn't cost them anything extra. But basically, they are in the habit of finding companies. They wait until they get big enough to have some money and then say, you know, this very basic stuff that you're doing violates our patent. We, for instance, own the patent on alphabetizing things. We think you're doing that. And they will send the very scary cease and desist letter. And these companies will say, well, we actually turned a profit this year. We're pretty happy. We think we're going to make it. A patent lawyer. Did we budget for a patent lawyer? How much does a patent lawyer cost? Oh, shit. And so they discover real quickly what they're going to do is settle. And the patent trolls get fed. And they have become really a big problem for entrepreneurs, especially in the technical fields, because there are so many bad patents being written that you end up with cases where you have, we're suing you for violating our 18 patents, which no one understood when they were filed. And no one understands now, but we're pretty sure what you're doing is it, and you're going to have to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars to a litigation team to prove that we're wrong. It's not how it's supposed to work, but functionally that's how it's going these days. So patents have their own issues, and like I said, the biggest problem right now is that software patents especially, but anything, when you can patent swinging sideways on a swing, you know that it's not going to be predictable or useful. I'm thinking kids had been doing that before, and all it took was for it to have been done in public, and that's prior art. It didn't have to be published in a research paper. Someone had to already have done it. I don't know who the hell the patent examiner was that passed that one. Apparently, he had never been allowed to play on a playground, or he would have seen it. So this is where we're dealing with patents. The patent part of this case that we're talking about today was fairly small, but patents are a good match in some ways for software if they were done correctly. So we'll step into where I live in the academic world, where we don't worry about reality. We live in an ivory tower, and it's safe, and it's happy, and it's clean. In a perfect world, patents seem like a good option for software because software, at the end of the day, is doing something. It's instructions to the machine. The machine is doing stuff. Things are happening. It's running HVAC systems. It's doing all sorts of things. Some software is a little less physical, but software that is in some cases will be patentable. Not all software is patentable. Just an algorithm, it will not be patentable. Many of y'all are familiar with the Bilski case, the machine or transformation test. If the software is attached to a machine or if it is transforming something, it's usually deemed patentable. That is not the only way to become patentable, but that is a test that you can use to discover if your software would be patentable or not. From a programmer standpoint, as I understand it, there's really not much point in patenting your software unless you're Apple or Oracle or someone like that, bec- because by the time you get it patented, it's not really useful anymore anyway, except if you're Apple or Google and want, or Apple or Oracle and want to have big lawsuits like this. So it's not a perfect fit because the software industry just doesn't match well with patents, and the way it's being done, the application, is insane. But honestly, that's true across the board. I know that the technical community was all hot and bothered when Bilski was being handed down, hoping that software patents would be overturned in Bilski. It was not. The rest of the legal world was really hoping that Bilski might overturn business method patents. I was joking about, we patented alphabetically filing things. Yeah, I think someone filed that patent. Business method patents are another case where this is how we do our business. And stupid things like having a line queue up in your bank lobby, people try to patent things like that. And it's just not what patents were intended for. Patents are supposed to be science, machinery, inventions, those things, not, oh, I arranged my files alphabetically by the last name of the client. Ooh, yeah, that shouldn't be even filed, much less granted. So the patents are a better match for software from an academic standpoint. Copyright is where all software is protected. Copyright law does not protect function. Remember I talked about in patent the process or the machine or the invention. Well, in software, the process of making insulin out of sugar beets, that process would be patentable. Something's happening. In copyright, if I wrote a book about processing insulin from sugar beets, my book would be copywritten. My book would be protected. You couldn't just copy my book. You couldn't use my words without my permission. But you could go and perform that process all day long, and I have no rights to the process. Copyright only protects the expression, not the idea. Copyright's supposed to be the artsy stuff. It's way easier than patents, by the way. That's why I practice copyright, not patents. So copyright is supposed to be the artsy, happy stuff. It's supposed to be sculptures, books, movies, songs, things along those lines. Artwork. It doesn't have to be good artwork. It could be really bad. You know, a haiku. Many of y'all wrote those. I saw one on a t-shirt today. You know, something about haikus are easy, sometimes they don't make sense, refrigerator. It was a cute t-shirt. That, by virtue of being written down somewhere, was covered by copyright law. That's another important thing about copyright. If you have written it down, fixed in a tangible medium, is our legal term, it's covered. Now, if it's something you care about, you should take time to go on libraryofcongress.gov and file it. It's easy to do. You basically tell them your name and send them a copy of your work, and you're done, and $35. I mean, this is easy and it's cheap. It's like the antithesis of patents. So it's easy to do, and it covers it automatically. Upon fixation, your work is covered by copyright. But again, the important thing for this purpose about copyright is that it only protects the expression of the idea, not the idea. An example of that is one of the big foundation cases. Judge Alsop even mentions it in his opinion. Baker v. Selden. All copyright students learn this. I teach it each semester. The original work in Baker v. Selden was a book on accounting. It's like 100 years old. This is not a new case. And it's and they still said it. It's still the case because it was actually well written and made sense. The work was a book on accounting, and inherent in that book, and it was like the first use of dual column accounting. It was cutting edge for its day, and it had a bunch of forms at the back, tables that you could actually copy and use to run your bookkeeping that way. This was before there were computers, so you actually would either copy them with a straight edge or with a Xerox, but this was, in order to use the system, you would use it, and you know, here's some tables to help you get started. Well, okay, if it's a good enough idea, you know that someone's going to steal it, and someone did, and printed their own book, which, as is usually the case, sold better than the original work, and had, now they wrote their own book, but they copied the tables. They copied the process, and they copied the tables. Well, process is okay. You can copy a process if it's only protected by copyright. The process would be protected by patent, and you couldn't do it without permission if it were patented. But since it was a copy, the book was covered by copyright, the system and the process was not protected at all. So the guy was perfectly safe to go write another book about the same process that the original author had made up himself. And as it turns out, the infringing author was not an infringing author. He was allowed to blatantly copy the tables out of the back of the book because the court found that, you know, the author has no right to this method. And the copyright law has since been amended, and it expressly picked up the language out of Baker v. Selden, so that copyright expressly excludes processes and methods and operations like that. And so but in this case, justices were finding it for the first time, saying, look, there's no right to the underlying process or method of operation, only the expression. But in this case, the tables would have been an expression because they were an original work. But the judges found that you couldn't really use the process without using these tables. There wasn't really any other way practically to make a table that would work with this bookkeeping system. And so because of that, it's what we call the merger doctrine. The idea and the expression are deemed to have merged because there's really only one or very few ways to do this practically. So we're not going to give you a monopoly over the process. You don't get to sneak in that way. They can copy the tables out of your book because they're not covered by your copyright. And that's important in a lot of ways for the case we're looking at today. An example, there's a case that I usually teach because it's more fun. There was a guy who came up with a theory that, which one was it? Dillinger. Dillinger didn't actually die in that car riddled with bullets when the FBI was shooting him down. He was in front of the movie theater? He was on the shot in front of the movie theater, right?
Yeah.
So that wasn't really him. That was someone who looked like him, and the lady in the red dress set him up or something. I forget the whole conspiracy theory, but there's this guy who came up with the theory that Dillinger wasn't dead, he wasn't there in front of the movie theater, he was somewhere else completely, and look, this unmarked grave was him, I'm sure of it because I saw the grave. Yeah, and he went down and had a whole lot of reasons why, because some guy who knew Dillinger said so, and wrote this book that did not sell many copies. I mean, I'm not sure how many friends he had, but I think that the number of copies he sold was roughly equivalent to that. And it was this theory about Dillinger was never killed there. Okay, great. Along comes the TV show Simon and Simon, a cute little detective show back when detective shows were cute and not gritty and ugly. And basically, one of the scriptwriters had obviously seen this book, lifted the story out of it, and put it into the Simon and Simon episode. Well, okay. He didn't use any of the words from the book, but he lifted this entire historical theory and put it in his script. And the dude who wrote the book said, hey, wait, as he's watching Simon and Simon one Friday evening, I wrote that. And of course, he did what any good red-blooded American would do. He called his lawyer, and a lawsuit ensued. And the court said, you know, you wrote this as a nonfiction piece. You could have called it fiction. It could be either way. But you said it was real. We know better, but you said it was real. And therefore, all that Simon and Simon took from your work were the uncopyrightable facts and ideas. Those aren't protected since you wrote it as a historical book. You could have written it as a bunch of crap, and then they couldn't have taken quite as much, but you said it was fact, and therefore they can take anything you claimed was a fact. And they did. I mean, and it was very obvious that he lifted the whole silly theory, except I think they actually cast someone as Dillinger to run through. But because he had written it as fact, the TV writer was perfectly allowed to steal it because copyright doesn't cover the facts. Whatever I write about in my book is not covered. How I say it, that's covered. So my expression, not my idea, and not my any facts that are in there. Kind of a clear concept there when I describe it that way. In copyright law, as in pretty much any other law, the problem comes in actually applying it. So if I tell you that I am writing a story about a boy and a girl from warring families, oh, I'll set it in Verona, Italy. Perhaps you have a hint of where I'm going with that. You know, boy meets girl, boy falls in love with girl, things go badly. Well, I've just described every book written, but I can go down to a level of specificity that makes it clear I'm talking about Romeo and Juliet. I can go a slightly different track, sing and dance a little bit, and I've got West Side Story for you. And on some level, West Side Story and Romeo and Juliet are similar enough that they're the same idea. The idea is not protectable. At some point, that idea becomes tangible enough, it's detailed enough in its expression, that it becomes expression. Somewhere between boy meets girl, things go badly, and the actual script for Romeo and Juliet, somewhere between those two points, it stopped being unprotected idea and became protectable expression. How much could I take from Romeo and Juliet and write my own, assuming it were copyrighted, which of course by now it is not, But assuming Shakespeare was still around with his copyright, how much of that idea, how much of Romeo and Juliet could inspire me to write my own book? How close could it be to Romeo and Juliet before I was infringing his copyright? You know, we know the extremes. Boy meets girl, things go badly. I can write that book. How could I write it in verse? Could I write it in, iambic pentameter? Could I put them in Verona? Could I put them in tights? You know, how far can I get before I'm too close? You don't usually know until a judge tells you. The extremes are obvious, in between not so much. And that's often where we have problems with the copyright of software. Software obviously was not originally intended in copyright, because copyright dates back to the Statute of Anne in the 1600s in England. Pretty much as soon as the printing press was invented, copyright law was invented. And obviously they weren't thinking about software then. And today if you read some of the scholarship on it, you will think that computers are the first things that have ever been invented that have been unanticipated in the law. Okay, fax machines were brand new and scary at one point. And actually, ironically, in copyright law, there were some really interesting, really hard-fought scholarship battles about whether photographs would be covered by copyright law. Today, yes, duh, photography is art, it's covered, no problem. At the time, though, a lot of people took the exact opposite view and said, this isn't artistic, this isn't creative, this is some dude with a big-ass machine that goes poof and makes an exact replication of whatever's in front of them. There's no artistry to that, there's no creativity to that. So it shouldn't be covered by copyright. Eventually the law went against them, and photography is now, of course, part of copyright. Well, we say of course, but for years, 100 years ago, it was a real hard choice. And it came out that we decided it was. There's a famous case that involved a portrait of Oscar Wilde. All copyright students see this portrait, and this is pretty much the one that the photographer turned the tide on. It was the first case that said, okay, because he said, look, I dressed Oscar Wilde in this puffy shirt and this velvet cloak, and I posed him thusly with a faraway look in his eyes. Actually, I think it was the absinthe, but that's okay. And I created this image of Oscar Wilde. It's not just a exact replica of something that occurred out in nature, it is the way I staged it. And that set the tide for even, Ansel Adams. He went out and took black and white pictures of big open spaces. That counts too. Photography now definitely is in, but again, it's the artistry behind it. To be covered by copyright, you don't have to be really original. You just be a little original. And by that, we don't mean you have to be terribly creative. You just have to be the one that actually wrote it. There had to be some originality for what is in there. And it doesn't have to be much, but there has to be a little bit. Not like patent, where you have to be the first one to have ever done this. If I were on a desert island somewhere and I were to have written Livin' La Vida Loca at the same time Ricky Martin was here singing it, I would not be infringing his copyright, because I did not copy his song. I wrote it alone on a desert island. One wonders why I would have come up with that song. But if I had, it would have been okay. If I independently created, I have not copied him, and he cannot sue me for infringement. Again, very different from patent, where even if I invented on my own, I can't use his patented process. But in copyright, it's only a violation if I'm copying his. Again, an issue when we come into software. So software doesn't really fit into this all about the expression and all about the artistry and all about the fluffy pretty stuff. There's also a long-standing line of copyright cases that kind of deals with when art and function interlap. There's the famous case, again, lawyers are weird, and we all know this there's a very picture that all lawyers who do copyright know of. It's a lamp, and the face of the lamp is a scantily clad Balinese dancer. And this was like the big case. We've all seen this dancer on the lamp. And the question was, is that naked lady part protectable or not? If she was standing by herself, she'd be a sculpture, she'd be protected. But there's wires running through her head, and she lights up. So she's functional. Is she still covered by copyright? The basic rule there, again, is easy. The application of it gets silly. But the functional aspects of that, the lamp, are not at all covered. And the idea of putting a scantily clad woman in a lamp is not covered, but that exact sculptural image is. So if I have something that is both pretty and functional, copyright will cover the pretty part, but it's not going to cover the functional part. kind of analogous to it covers my expression, but not the facts in my book. If I make something, and I have a whole bevy, I have measuring cups that are kind of shaped like a goose. I have a lamp with a horse rather than a naked woman. Once you start teaching copyright, you see these things in thrift shops and you buy them. It's kind of a sickness with us. But so I have these little things with a goose that are measuring cups that look like little geese. They're kind of cute. They're kind of kitschy. I have a tiki cup. It looks like a little tiki sculpture, and you drink booze out of it, because if you're drinking out of a tiki cup, it's got to be booze. Well, the tiki sculpture part would arguably be protected. The idea of carving out a tiki and drinking booze through it is not going to be protected by copyright. So each of those things, if you can separate the art from the function's not covered, the art is. Okay, this all makes sense for copyright. Where did we get software? Well, software is a writing, and if it's on a computer, it counts. When Congress started addressing whether software should be included, and when judges started being faced with it, you have to kind of set your wayback machine. This is back in the early 70s when this issue started coming up. No one owned computers in the 70s. They had them on Star Trek, and they had them in graduate labs at major universities. And if you tripped on the way to presenting your doctoral thesis, you wouldn't be able to do it because the punch cards would fall all over the ground, and that would ruin your program. And it would have taken boxes and boxes of punch cards to pick a number 1 through 10, which I didn't crash the main thing with in 10 lines. So computers were not something people were commonly aware of. No one used them. Secretaries didn't have them. Oh, punch cards! Yay!
It's a 5081.
This used to be what drove your computer. And this is the state of the art when this became a question in courtrooms. So when they started trying to say, well, should software be covered? Not only did you have a bunch of lawyers, congressmen are all lawyers, judges are all lawyers, so you have a whole bunch of lawyers who are like me, although at that point they're probably all men, but you have a bunch of lawyers like me trying to decide whether this is going to have anything to do with copyright or not. Well, we have vague ideas that holes get punched in these because we've seen them, and that's about as far as we would know. Today, at least, lawyers use computers. So if you describe it using small enough words, we eventually understand what you're talking about. But back then, no one had these things. It was only those weird guys back in the lab that were using them. And no one else ever saw them. I know we've got some, right?
I
accounts?
Me too.
Someone's dad, when I was in elementary school, donated a bunch of these to us. We colored on them. They all had holes punched in them, but we thought it was kind of fun. So the judges were starting to be convinced that, okay, it's an expression, because you could show them the source code and they could see it's a writing. It's gibberish, but it's a writing. Okay, I'm with you. For copyright, it doesn't have to be clever. It doesn't have to be useful. In fact, it can't be useful. And, okay, we're looking at saying it's an expression. You can write it down. I can see it. It should be copyrightable. And Congress kind of said, okay, that's kind of the direction it's going. We're a little bit unclear on this. So they did what Congress likes to do and formed a committee. Yay! CONTU, the Committee on New Technology Uses. There have been other words suggested as an acronym to apply to this particular committee. And this committee, as is the case for many congressional committees, had no one with any relevant experience whatsoever. The congressman went and picked a bunch of people just like themselves, maybe their brothers-in-law who needed jobs, I'm not sure, but there was not a single programmer or technical person on the committee. And these commissioners had to figure out whether software should be used, and they said, yes, both object and source code should be included in the Copyright Act. Our job here is done. Congress said, oh, good, we didn't have to decide. We'll follow the advice of our experts. And boom, there it is. Well, we have a problem. Because if you go on an abstract level, okay, software, you can write it down. And honestly, this was told to me by an older litigator who said that one of the reasons the case law started going in that trend was one very clever litigator. Oh, goody, we have a piece of paper. I never expected there to be paper in this room. It's usually too high-tech for that. And this litigator, when they still did flip charts for courtrooms, he was in front of the judges, and he was hired by the guys who wanted to copyright their software and wanted the binary code parts of it to be covered also. And he said, look, and he had page after page at that. And he said, look, this is what it is. And he would flip the chart over, ones and zeros. It's all ones and zeros. Well, he put it on paper, and the judge said, aha, look, it's an expression. And this, by the way, is currently covered by federal copyright. And the judge looked at that and said, oh, good, you've done something I understand finally. That can be covered. Alrighty then. Source and object code both should be covered, because I get that. And that's usually how technical cases get decided. Whichever lawyer comes up with something that makes sense to the judge wins. This guy did something that made sense, and he won, and set the direction of software law going forward. But all of y'all were already starting to see where the problem here is. The stuff the machines actually read and do is the instructions for the machine to do stuff. Doing stuff is not copyright. And something that humans can't read but machines use, and it provides instructions for machines to do things that are sufficient enough processes and operations and transformation procedures that could be covered by patent, can't also be covered by copyright. The two should be mutually exclusive, and yet they're not. And so we have an entire doctrine of law that doesn't fit well with software. It never has, and it can't by nature of what copyright is supposed to be. Nevertheless, copyright covers code, and thus we have a case like Oracle v. Google. And our problem with Oracle v. Google is that most judges would have sat there and said, wow, I really wish I understood what you're talking about, but I don't, so I'm going to listen and nod until you say something I understand. In this case, the judge is a programmer, and there's a bit of dialogue that if I had video or something, I would ask them how to show it. But it was a lovely piece of the court record where the Oracle attorney clearly is a lawyer like me, except he's a courtroom guy. I do transactional work and now academic stuff, even further removed from reality. But the Oracle lawyer was talking about one section of code that was exactly copied. It was 9 lines of a little subroutine thingy called range check, which, as I understand it, basically checked to make sure that all the numbers that were entered were within the appropriate range. Okay, sounds clever. And the Oracle guy was saying, they stole these 9 lines of code out of the bajillions of lines of code. These were the only 9 that were actually directly copied. And the Oracle guy was trying to prove, and this is after his ship was pretty well sinking, that these were copied intentionally by those evil thieving bastards at Android. Those nasty Google people stole it from us on purpose because they were in a hurry. They knew the faster they got to market, the faster they would start making money, and they make $8 bajillion every day. And they got to market 5 days sooner because they copied this code and didn't have to write it themselves. Okay, that actually would have worked on a lot of judges. We understand the idea of rushing to market. We understand the idea of getting there first gets you more money. We even understand, even though it wasn't the first to do this, they make gajillions of dollars per day. So if they got there 5 days earlier, that's 5 gajillion extra dollars. And the Oracle theory was, since they got to market 5 days early and made 5 gajillion extra dollars, we should get that $5 gajillion. And again, for a normal judge, that kind of would have resonated. It's like, oh, money and time. Oh, we get that. We bill for our time. We understand money and time. The judge, however, was a programmer, and he's like, and he stopped the guy. And I don't think he actually attributed it to, like, the off source of a bovine animal, but he came this close to saying that in court. And he's like, look, no, a high school kid could do that in 10 minutes. I could do that in 10 minutes. And the programmer, the lawyer, wasn't quite following what he was saying. He's like, well, yes, but I want to get back to this thing about range check. And the judge is like, that's what I'm talking about. These 9 lines, yeah, they're not particularly difficult. Anyone could do that. It didn't get you. Yes, they copied it, and there'll be eventually some statutory damages for that. Okay. But statutory damages are like an hour of the legal team's time. That's about it. And Oracle was wanting the $8 gajillion. They didn't get $8 gajillion because the judge knew better. He's like, no, that's 10 minutes of work, if that. So, yes, they copied it. Yes, they're bad. And they've admitted that. They've admitted it was an inadvertent copying. They're going to get hit with statutory damages. What you're saying is just ridiculous. He uses, in his opinion, the words overblown and ridiculous. In the actual questioning in his court, he was a little more direct. And when he stood up and said, I program in this language, everyone in the back where the reporters were sitting went, ho-ho, and all of the techie blogs lit up and said, look, he's a programmer, yay! And sure enough, he's written a great opinion. As a result, the whole middle of it is technical. You don't usually get that unless the judge is lifting it out of one or the other briefs. This guy got it. So let me give you the kind of basic overall of what happened in this case, now that we kind of understand the background for it. You have Oracle suing Google because Google has used Java to write their Android platform. Now, originally, they tried to get licensing rights to do it from Sun. Those negotiations didn't go anywhere. They said, okay, we'll just use the parts we're allowed to use by ourselves. Never mind. Oracle bought Sun, and now Oracle's suing Google. They have patents. They have copyrights at issue. The patents would be a more complex issue, usually, and these were the two patents that the software guys who read it said, if it means anything, it means these are stupid patents. And the jury, somehow, because they're a jury, not even a judge, but a jury, said there's no infringement of this. So you had a whole bunch of lawyers arguing a lot of stuff in front of the jury and convinced them that there was no infringement. Poof, patent claim is gone. The copyright claim was a little more complicated, because what they were claiming had been copied was not just the 8-line, 9-line range check program that was copied. And then there were a few, there's another chunk of code that was copied that was used in a test version of it, was never released. But it was technically copied, and they got statutory damages for that as well. But the big thing that they were claiming was that you used our APIs, the application programming interfaces. And this is where the judge had to, you know, get down a little ways to explain it to the rest of the lawyers, and he started describing it in terms of libraries, bookcases, shelves, books, and chapters. And all of the lawyers then went, oh, good, thank God, I know what those are. Oh, okay, so basically what these packages of code are doing is telling the computer to go here and here and here, exactly, read that and does what it says and do what it says. Oh, I get that. Okay, I do that all the time. I get told to go to the library and find stuff. I find where it is and I do what it says. I understand that. But that is more of an organizational thing. And remember the merger doctrine from Baker and Selden. To use Java, you kind of got to do that. Another thing about copyright is that copyright does not attach to short phrases or names. Names would be trademarks. If you want to protect your name as the source of your goods, that's trademarks. That's not today's issue. Never did Oracle, never did Google claim that they were Oracle or claim that they were Sun, so that would have been a different thing. But you can't copyright just a chapter heading or, back in the real book world, you can't copyright just a title or a heading. That's why there are lots of songs with the same titles, lots of books with the same titles. Because when we're dealing with copyrights, we want to make sure that no one gets to own any words. If I call my book Red Sky at Sunset, okay, someone else has used that phrase. I can't own that phrase. I don't get to, if I wanted to call mine Red Dawn, someone's done that once or twice at least. Well, it's okay. Someone else can do it again because you can't own a short phrase like that because it takes the entire phrase out of the public domain. We won't let you do that. That's not your expression. That's owning a word. I can own my whole book, but those little words I don't get to own. So the little words, in effect, the little packets that were part of the APIs are both functional and short. And so on two different levels, they're not subject to copyright. And Oracle really didn't like hearing that. They were really, really unhappy because that's where the big money was going to come. Now, the judge did something in here also that I wanted to highlight because it's another sort of legal thing. And they didn't tell the jury that they were doing this. I thought that was really funny. He admits that in his opinion. He separated a couple things out because he's a district court judge. Sadly, this is not the end of the case. Oracle will appeal. We can assume that. Actually, I would love to be a fly on the wall in the litigator's office sitting with the decision makers for Oracle trying to convince them after this spanking they got from this judge that they should spend another gajillion dollars to appeal it. You almost think that surely Oracle is going to stop and say, oh, come on, we can't win this. Look at what this judge said. But they're going to appeal. And the judge knows they're going to appeal, so he wrote his entire opinion with the intention that the appellate court can use it as written. and he separated a couple of the issues, because juries an appellate court makes findings of law, a judge makes a finding of law, and a district court is where all the facts are brought out. The appellate court, you don't get all of the exhibits, you don't get all the experts, you don't get all the testimony. They read transcripts, they read opinions. You don't get the same dog and pony show that you get in the district court. So what he has done is he separated out the patent issue, and boom, that one went away. He gave to the jury the issue of, okay, assuming that all this stuff is copyrightable, did Google infringe the copyright in the APIs, and was it a fair use? We'll get to fair use in a second. So the judge was saying, that's the jury's question. I will decide later if it's actually copyrightable or not. But he didn't mention that to the jury. He said, assume that this is protectable, and then tell me if it was infringement. Jury's job to do, there's infringement. If this is protectable, then yes, it's been infringed, because they didn't copy it exactly, but they copied the organization and the structures and the sequences. And if it were something that was protectable by copyright, it would be infringing. And the jury got that right, because it's close enough, borrowing the expression, that it would count as infringement if it were something that was protectable. And the judge didn't tell them that he was later going to rule on that. He just told them to go to say, it's protectable, is it infringed, and is the use a fair one? And the jury came back saying, yes, it's infringement, they're correct. And they came back saying, we have no idea if it's a fair use. They hung on that. And they could not come to a decision, which, given the current state of fair use law, is probably also a good decision, because I have no idea. I can't even imagine how you would apply that in this case, much less come to a good decision. And fair use, I have an article I love written by Judge Laval of the Second Circuit 20 years ago discussing how horrible a morass fair use is. I'm like, well, I don't feel so bad being confused. This really smart guy who's famous for this area of law says he doesn't get it. Oh, right, I feel better. I can't ever predict what it's going to be. And he's like, I can't either. I have no clue. But he hoped that very soon the judges were going to come together, there'd start being some real good concrete outlines. That was 20 years ago. It hadn't happened yet. So, frankly, I think the jury was right to have no idea if it's fair use or not. But that was what the jury came back with. And this is when, you know, Oracle started doing the little happy dance, like, ha, 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 you infringed. And then the judge said, yeah, that's cute, but no. Because all this time he had been working on his order, which is, you know what, these things are not copyrightable, and for the reasons we just discussed. Well, that issue that he wrote is going to be what Oracle can appeal. They can't really overturn the jury's findings. They can overturn the law that the judge may have gotten wrong. And he very carefully, in his opinion, I keep pointing to this because this is a copy of the opinion, by the way, just in case you're wondering why I keep pointing randomly over at the desk. He very carefully wrote a couple of things out in his opinion that he set apart as a finding of fact. And the courts, the upper courts, will take his findings of fact and take them as true. They don't get to mess with those on appeal. And he wrote his findings of fact in a very nice stacked up way, such that he's really pushing that appellate court into following his holding as well. He uses some very clever language in very several parts of stuff that we're saying, well, and the issue is whether Google was going to be able to use the organization and process of this language. I'm like, wow, if you phrase it that way, it's a really easy question. Clever boy. If you phrase the question that way, the only answer is the one you got. That's not how Oracle would have phrased the question. But that's how he's phrasing it for the appellate court to pick up on it later. So hopefully he has given the appellate court enough of a narrow channel to go down that they will just go down it and stick with his well-reasoned thing. You can't own the function. You can't own the only way to do something. But one of the earlier cases, and again, this is where lawyers like going to these cases, we understood this. When one of the early, I think it's when Betamax manufacturers wanted to say that no one else could use play, stop, rewind, and fast forward on their machines, because they already had used that. And you're copying our buttons. You're copying play, stop, fast forward, and eject, I think also was theirs. And the judge there is able to say, oh, no, this is easy. Short phrases, words cannot be protected by copyright. You don't get to own play for play. And that was worked out well. Everyone can use those. And that case is the one we still cite when we say things like these APIs and the, you know, we can call them class libraries. We learn lots of words to describe them, even though as non-technical judges, they don't know what it actually means. But we understand play, stop, and record. This is the same thing as that. Lawyers always reason by analogy. We reason it back to that, and look, we understand, and it's not protectable. And that's kind of where it's been left. So as it stands right now, Apple was, or not Apple, Oracle won on some verbatim copying, those 9 lines and the other stuff that was used in only the test version. Yes, that was copied. You get statutory damages, like $150,000. I mean, I don't want to write the check for that, but it's a human amount of money. And it won't even cover a day's legal fees for them. But the 8 gajillion they were after from Google, no. Google can do what it wants. All of y'all continue to program in Java without being violating anyone's copyright. And the world is still free for safety and democracy and freedom, all those good things. And that's where it stands. And it will probably be appealed. So we'll be back next year or 5 years from now when the appeal is decided, and we'll see how they did on it. But this is where we got so far. And the, like I said, the opinion is really, really well done. He got the copyright law right, which I always like to see. And when I've had my tech friends read it, they said, no, actually, that's true. That's how you describe Java. Because I have a handful of friends who are hardcore computer programmers. I let them sometimes read the legal opinions that describe some of these things, and they just laugh themselves stupid over how almost right the judges are when they're describing things. But usually the judges are just lifting things out of the briefs and hoping that it's close. So that's kind of where we stand on Oracle and Google. We have questions usually. Anyone have a question? Because I'm about, yeah.
Apple, Samsung, in some ways related.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that in Oracle, Google, the facts from the jury could not be appealed, only the application of the law that the judge.
You're usually not able to mess with the district court's finding of fact. That's what they do. The appellate courts aren't set up to handle all of the messy facts. That's the trial court. That's where we have the long trial of all the things, and the findings of fact are taken by the appellate court. They can come to a different result, but they don't go and rehash all the original findings of fact. It's almost an efficient use of money, but not really.
In the case of Apple, Samsung, there were several things that seemed kind of out of line, like the jury disregarded the jury instructions. In fact, you had things that directly contradicted the instructions that they ignored.
That's not as uncommon as you might think. And that's sometimes that'll be grounds for appeal. When you have litigators who are being paid enough money, they will find a way to appeal all kinds of stuff. I mean, I've learned in law, again, I don't litigate, but I learned in law school that there had to be grounds for an appeal. And yet we all assume that Oracle is going to appeal this case, and no one's really asking what grounds it will have, because best we can tell, the grounds it will have is a really big checkbook to pay the litigators enough to bring it back to court. And so what they can appeal based on, what gives them the, you know, little hook to hang their huge case on, I couldn't even tell you.
Okay, but let's say it is appealed. Is there any grounds to go back and say, well, something was wrong with the jury's result, or do you have to take that as fact as fact?
It depends. When you get to that level of the trial court appellate practice, it's going to depend in large part on what the attorneys actually plead and what was maintained for pleading, and I wouldn't know what the standing on that case was sufficiently to answer that, because it depends on exactly how things were done and what the lawyers actually appeal on. So, I don't know, would be the short answer. Yeah?
You mentioned that in short words can be copyrighted.
Correct.
What about catchphrases and tags, you know, like LG's got life's good?
That would be a trademark.
Okay.
Their slogans and logos and things like that, those can be protected by trademark, but they won't be protectable as copyright. You don't get to own words. And if you've got to own a phrase that short, in effect, you own the words. No one else could use those two words in that order. And copyright is not intended to be that specific. But when you use it like LG or the Life is Good folks, who have the same little slogan, by the way, you're using it to identify the source of your goods, and it's really a consumer protection concept. We want to make sure that if you see that slogan or hear that jingle or see that brand name, that you know what you're getting and where you're getting it from. And that, so the little short catchphrases would be more of a trademark issue than a copyright thing. Anyone else? Yeah?
How does international law factor into this?
Not at all for questions of United States copyright law.
So are these international companies going to be practicing
Well, the Samsung case, Apple and Samsung have been fighting this out all across the globe. Coincidentally, Apple seems to have won here and Samsung won in Korea. Fancy that.
Same day.
Okay. So, yeah, I'm sure that was just a coincidence. It had nothing to do with home court advantage. But it's each country has its own laws, and if you are in this country, you're violating our software law or our IP laws. If you're in Korea, you're violating theirs. There are treaties between us. But in this case, if you're being tried here, it's for violating my U.S. patent or for violating my U.S. copyright.
Could Oracle in another country sue?
Oh, sure. They do it all the time.
For the same thing? Or?
The Apple-Samsung case is the exact same case being tried out in multiple courts across the world.
Germany, South Korea, Japan, the Netherlands, because they're on a separate thing in the EU, mm-hmm. and the U.S.
And Australia.
Australia, yeah. I think so as well.
But though the UK also for Apple Samsung. Apple had to run ads saying Samsung didn't copy them.
Oh, that's kind of embarrassing, isn't it, when they are then saying in another country, well, I didn't mean that. They made me say it. Not fair. They stomp a lot. Yeah.
But other countries can use findings from other countries for proof. We have a precedent where other countries have found...
We don't have to follow foreign precedent. It can be used to try to be persuasive. I can say, look, in these 18 countries, Apple has tried this and lost. Well, instead, Apple's going to say, oh, I won here. And Samsung's like, oh, yeah, well, I won there. And so it doesn't become real persuasive. It's kind of a mixed bag. But you can go and say, look, yeah, we argued this out before. You said this before. You were wrong then, too. And you can use that persuasively, but a U.S. judge does not have to ever follow the findings of a foreign judge. Yeah?
Doesn't that differ depending on, like, whether it's common law or civil law? Because, like, I mean, traditionally, I think there were common law cases that say, at, like, foreign precedent, like...
I'm not sure I follow your question.
Written law, common law.
Yeah, common law, basically, you know, it's
trumped by statutory law, and these are all statutory cases.
Oh.
So you do sometimes have a common law right to intellectual property, but these cases have all been based on federal code. Yeah. So if you're talking about a civil law state like France, then it's a whole different world, and their opinions are completely different. But our system. I mean, we do have common law rights, but when you have the federal statute, that's what all these cases are about. Does that get to what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah?
In criminal law, we've seen where the U.S. has tried U.S. people who committed crimes in other countries locally.
Mm-hmm.
Is anything like that going over to the civil side? Could it be a case of where, you know, Apple could bring a case against Samsung in the U.S. or something they did elsewhere?
Extraterritorial jurisdiction is a whole different ball of wax, and that varies with how we'll extend it. Antitrust is an example of that. It used to be that we said an antitrust violation happening anywhere in the world, this is an American banana case, back, say, when we were a huge, unchallenged superpower, we said, if our law is broken anywhere in the world, we can try you for it here. We've drawn back from that. We don't really do that anymore. And so whether a crime in another place can be tried here is sometimes a matter of treaty, is sometimes a matter of jurisdiction, is sometimes a matter of policy. With respect to a civil case, like I said, antitrust is both criminal and civil, actually, but you cannot usually sue in this country for something that was done outside of this country. It's called extraterritorial jurisdiction. It's usually not done. There are times when it can be. And so again, it varies. I mean, the antitrust one is hysterical because you can actually map it on a grid and it follows our rise and fall as an international hegemon almost to the date. I mean, there are major opinions in both cases right along a little bell curve. And so there's not one correct answer to that. But as a general rule, you're going to be tried under the laws of the country where it happened. And that's why you need to be careful when you go abroad, because things that are crimes in other countries that are not crimes here are still crimes that you can be thrown in a nasty foreign jail for, much to your surprise in many cases. The American law does not follow you around the globe.
So like the young kid who got caned in Thailand?
Yeah, who probably deserved it. Yeah.
So what about like network interactions? Like say you have like a thin fly in one country and then like a server with something that infringes something in another or the opposite way around.
Jurisdiction is a huge ball of wax that litigators use to their advantage. We talk about if you have sufficient contacts with the local forum in order to be brought into our jurisdiction. So you have to have done something here in order to be tried here. And whether there's sufficient contact between your off-site server in the Canary Islands and your local guy here selling ad time is, again, a jurisdictional issue, and that's a pure litigation issue, and it's going to vary based on what exactly you've done and what year it is.
I mean, that was the negative of
what
happens, right?
Yeah.
We wouldn't keep the server outside the U.S.
We said that sufficient contacts, they're messing with our market, we can go get them. So there's a little bit of cowboy, and we will go get you anywhere if we can justify it. And so we'll find some nice legal grounds to justify it and then say, okay, look, just because you put the server over there, you're not fooling us. You're mucking with us here with those servers, so we'll go get your servers there. Depending on what country they're in also, their treaty issues. Are they going to scream at us when we go there and do that? Or can we set it up with the government and say it's okay? I mean, we went after bin Laden in foreign soil. We didn't ask permission. We just did it. So there are times when we do and times when we play nice. Yeah?
I was going to add on mega really kind of unprecedented, I would say. And most of it's probably getting out.
But it stopped it.
What?
You know, it kind of had the effect they wanted.
Well, Russia Direct is under domain seizure by the DOJ.
Mm-hmm.
They did all of it earlier this month. And sorry, you lost your domain for 2 years.
Yeah. Our bad.
Yeah, exactly. The damage is done, but just the fact that those are things we're still being sorted out.
Yeah, a lot of that's still being settled because the old rules about jurisdiction were set up when, you know, the cutting technology was telephones. And if I mean, at one point they found interstate commerce by virtue of having a telephone on your desk because you could call another state. Therefore, we bound you into some federal jurisdiction based on that, which was really kind of a stretch. But we kind of accept that now. And so what counts as a sufficient contact changes over time. And how far the government's willing to go really changes dramatically. And a lot of it's very pragmatic. We can come up with a great legal theory to justify it because, you know, we're a nation of lawyers. And we can justify anything given long enough and with big enough words. But a lot of times it's, okay, this is what we're going to do, make it sound good. Yeah.
So do you think that this case is going to be, you know, this is going to be the case we think of in the next couple, you know, 10, 20 years where this is the rule now, we can't do this, and that's the case we go back to? Do you think that's going to change a lot, or do you think they're going to appeal?
It'll depend what's on the appellate record. District court cases are never the big case that we listen to forever and ever. It's the appellate court cases that lawyers really give credence to. If it goes to the Supreme Court, then every IP lawyer in the world will cite it all the time. If it goes to the Ninth Circuit, which we're assuming that Oracle, you know, sad loser that they are, will appeal it, that if it's a Ninth Circuit case, people will cite it. If it's a Supreme Court case, everyone will follow it. But if it's a Ninth Circuit case, it'll be cited, it'll be followed in the Ninth Circuit. The other circuits will either cite it because it's good law and it's persuasive, or they'll say, oh, for pity's sake, that's the Ninth Circuit, we just don't listen to them, and they move on with their own lives. So it'll really depend on where it goes next. If it stays here, academics will cite it, techie people will cite it because it's a judge who wrote intelligently, and that'll be it.
If that's, as far as it goes, how much influence would it have on another future case that would be similar?
It would be persuasive evidence. They could bring it up saying, look, this judge said this. Wasn't he smart? Don't you believe him? And sometimes, look, he understood it and he said this. You don't understand it. Maybe you should believe him. So be persuasive, but another judge would not have to follow it. If it goes to the appeals court in the Ninth Circuit, it becomes law in the Ninth Circuit. All Ninth Circuit cases would have to follow it, including the lower courts, would have to follow that Ninth Circuit precedent. We're in the 11th Circuit. We would not have to follow it, but we would look at it and decide if we choose to follow it or not. We would be advised by it here in this circuit. And if it went all the way to the Supreme Court, all of us have to follow it, unless the judge doesn't want to follow it, in which case she will find a way to distinguish the case and pretend that it's different and do what she wanted to in the first place.
So it would be a critical interest to get it into the appeals court so that it would be a precedent that would be court?
Well, I guess it depends on what your interest is. If your interest is being Oracle and trying to get gajillions of dollars, well, if you don't appeal, you're not going to get them. If your interest is Google's and you want to just go off and mind your own business again and get out of this lawsuit, then you don't want to appeal it for the good of programming community. You want to say, look, I won, go to hell, and go on with your life.
But even if you discount any altruistic motivations, but if you want, I don't want to get sued about this in the future. And so having precedent set for it seems like that might be a nice.
In some ways, that could be true. From a legal standpoint, only the loser can appeal. The winner can't appeal. You can't say, well, I won, but I disagree.
But technically, Google lost. It got slapped.
Well, but all they would be able to appeal would be the part that they lost. And, you know, the first day of the appeal would cost more than the statutory damages. So they ain't going to do that. They're dancing still in their corporate offices. And punch has been made. You know, so they're having fun still. And the Oracle lawyers are trying to figure out how to explain to their clients that, well, we could too win. Yeah. The judge at least did throw them a bone. He has one paragraph in his opinion saying that both sides were represented very well by counsel. Both sets of lawyers did a fantastic job. I want to commend both counsels for a very professional and, you know, high quality job. And then he went on to spank the hell out of everything Oracle had said. So, but he did throw him a bone. They could say, look, see, he said we were good right there. He said we were good. So maybe, and I mean, they were good lawyers. I mean, you can look at the. Here, I'll show you guys this. This is amusing as hell. You can even see from there. This, you can see the size print here. This is the list of the lawyers for one side. This is Oracle's lawyers, and this is Google's lawyers. So there are a few people involved here, and some of those are just listing not just the individuals, some of those are listing entire departments. So some of those phrases are 50 people each. So there's a lot of lawyers involved here, and you can't say that Oracle's lawyers stunk because, I mean, those are some of the best lawyers we got, and they just didn't do a good job that time. There's something to be said with sometimes you just have a dog of a case if the judge understands it.
You got the wrong judge.
Yeah, for Oracle, they got the wrong judge. They should have had me because they could have convinced me of all kinds of stuff. This dude, they couldn't. One more.
Yeah. I was curious.
Yeah. I think they can just look at it. Yeah, Android is the open source version, so they went, look. Yeah, otherwise, they could have gone through discovery. Once you start filing the lawsuit, say, we have reason to believe this, then the courts can compel disclosure. And then it's always a fun game of, okay, do we either say, okay, tell us exactly what you want, or, and we will give you exactly what you want, no more, no less, or we will send discovery over in, you know, freight cars full of documents saying, here, search through all that. I'm sure it's in there somewhere. We didn't want to leave anything out, so we made sure that we gave you a very full disclosure. Good luck sorting through all that crap and finding the one email you were hoping to find. So there's two different strategies for that. Oh, well, you didn't say an email on April 3rd between these two parties and copied to this person. Oh, okay, well, we would have given you that if you'd asked for it. Or, well, here's the entire corporation's internal correspondence for the 3 years in question. Good luck. You can pay your mortgage in pennies, it's legal tender. Banks won't like you, though. Yes?
How do trade secrets play into that process?
Trade secret is, there are sections on that. It was originally a common law thing. The basic theory of a trade secret is just like a real secret. How do you keep something secret? You don't tell anyone. Well, if I have a corporate secret, there is actually a very famous one in the Koch Museum, that y'all can go see for a high ticket price. The Koch formula is a trade secret. They didn't patent it, and they can't copyright it, because a recipe can't be subject to copyright either. And so they just don't tell anyone. It's a secret because they keep it secret. The KFC's 11 herbs and spices, also a trade secret. Now, people have figured out what the Koch formula is. What they haven't figured out is the amounts. There's one particular chemical that you only get from one chemist in the Southeast, and he just laughs every time someone comes and asks him. He's like, oh, got a whole Koch formula, did you? You won't be able to make it, you know. And no one can, because they can't figure out the process or the amounts. But the formula is a trade secret. And basically, if you keep it secret and follow a few legal rules about how secret you keep it, then no one is allowed to sneak into your office and steal it. So you get a little bit more protection. But the basic thing is, if you keep it secret, it's a secret. Yeah?
I'm not quite sure how to formulate this question, but in relation to the trade secret issue, nearly everything that I get involved in, lately they want you to do a non-disclosure before they talk to you, before you walk in the door, and you're talking, and they won't tell you that what you're involved in is a trade secret, but you're supposed to protect it. But I'm like, how do I protect something if I don't know what I'm supposed to do?
That's mainly them protecting themselves, because one of the steps to keep your trade secret a secret is that you make anyone who's going to be in contact with it sign a non-disclosure agreement. And you can say, look, I took the reasonable steps to keep this protected. We made everyone who came into the building sign the non-disclosure agreement. And it also covers them if you did figure out what it was and tried to sell it to someone else. They can come after you with the additional force of the law, because not only were you telling someone something, you broke your non-disclosure agreement and you violated the trade secret. So they come after you twice.
Blanket. You don't know what you're actually supposed to not say.
Well, they're not really worried about you knowing what it is. They're worried about coming after you later if you do it. Yeah, if you sign an employment contract, it doesn't protect you.
The Human Resource Department is not about the human resource.
Yeah, it's not about humans. It's about resources. And I think we are about out of time. So thanks.